Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Douglas Whitfield joins me. We're going to be going to the library. No, we're going to be talking about how libraries manage those millions of things. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Douglas Whitfield, episode 396, recorded July 12, 2016, Koha ILS. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable, yet simple-to-use, storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit Drobo.com and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 off select Drobos, including the new B810i. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download and play with, projects that may do a lot of infrastructure stuff for you, but you're not even aware of doing it for that. I think that's today's show. I had to have a category for it. Joining me this week is another brand new co-host. I'd like to welcome Douglas Whitfield to the show. Welcome, Douglas.
Thank you, Randall. Good to be here.
And I'll let you introduce yourself since it's all sorts of things. So, go ahead.
I guess the short thing is I do a podcast in the lower third, musicmanagement.com. It's all about Creative Commons music, specifically stuff that's allowed for remix. We do a bit of music technology, so there's been a few guests overlaps. We've had AV Linux on, Ubuntu Studio, people like that. I also work for a Creative Commons record label. Not really the first, but the first that's doing it the way we do it, blocksonic.com. I know, like, back in November, I think you guys had on CC Mixter, or maybe that was November 2 years ago. It was November, I remember, because they were doing a campaign in November. So,
cool.
Yeah, so I think even though I have a master's degree that's accredited by the American Library Association, I like to think of myself as a jack of all trades, master of none. So,
well, it's particularly appropriate given today's topic then. So yeah. Today we have on KohaCommunity.org, Koha, the ILS. ILS, yeah. What's ILS stand for?
Integrated Library System in this particular scenario.
Right.
I'm
a pilot, so I know what ILS means to pilots. It's something quite different. We have a couple of people who are going to represent the project. We have Brendan Gallagher, and we have Nicole Enghardt, and they will be coming on shortly. So do you know anything about Koha?
A little bit. I mean, sort of, I guess, their biggest infamy, I don't know, claim to fame as far as the global news is they had a big trademark fight a few years ago. So I think that was how a lot of people were introduced to them, you know, like what's going on, you know, people are taking open source trademarks. And I think a lot of community members, you know, open source community members, that sort of scared a lot of people. So there was a big rallying cry around Koha. That's sort of like the thing that I know the most about them. I've never used the application in a library setting personally, though. So I'll be learning along with everybody else.
Cool. And we had the Evergreen Library System on about 3 years ago. That was episode 132, if you want to go check that out. So part of what I'll want to ask today is, how does this compare with that? I watched the first 2/3 of the Evergreen show just this morning in prepping for this show. So that'll be really cool. Let's see. Oh, you might want to spell the name of your podcast because a lot of people are listening on audio and they won't be able to get
it. That's true. That's a good point. So music, probably people can get that. So Manumit is Manumit. And it's the same root word as manumission. So if people think about, you know, like the Emancipation Proclamation, that's the same root word. And so it's all about music freedom.
Okay, cool. I never went to enough school to learn any of all that. But before we bring our guests on, because then we can actually ask them what we were asking each other, I do have a very important message. because digital data is essential to your life and your business. Drobo is the safe, simple, and expandable solution for all of your storage needs. Drobo offers a family of external storage arrays. We've talked about Drobos for home servers, photography, and video before, but this week we'll want to talk about the new Drobo for the small business office and the enterprise. Drobo has added to the high end of its product line, introducing the Drobo B810i. It's an 8-bay iSCSI SAN with data-aware tiering that offers full storage capabilities usually found in more expensive enterprise solutions. Data-aware tiering means that it automatically tiers frequently used transactional data from stored data that's seldom used. This enables businesses to consolidate storage resources and share that storage across all connected clients and their applications. You can access physical and virtual storage in a single array, with the on-demand ability to scale for both capacity and performance as needed. Smart Volumes allow you to create 255 individual drives with a maximum capacity of 64 terabytes each, provisioning as necessary. No more guessing how big to make each volume. Dual iSCSI ports for up to 2x gigabit Ethernet performance when you use MPIO in a Microsoft environment. Use it for collaboration, testing, development, backup, running Microsoft Exchange, or more. And it's perfect for the small or medium-sized businesses that don't yet have dedicated IT support. I personally have had a Drobo for about, 8 or 9 years, ever since I heard about him. It's sitting at home holding about 16 terabytes of information that I can access remotely over the net, so it's very cool. Because Drobos are reliable, data received by your Drobo that is not yet written to disk is protected if there's a sudden power loss. Even better, Drobos have an internal eUSB device where data is copied if there's a power failure to protect against long outages. It's expandable. Add or replace your Drobo with ease. No tools required. Beyond RAID technology lets you expand on the fly and mix and match drives. I know when I went from 1 terabyte drive to 4 terabyte drives, all I had to do is pull them out one at a time, and it was a really simple process. Any person can do it. It's also simple. The colored lights on the front of the Drobo communicate status. It's also fast. It supports iSCSI, Ethernet, and USB 3.0 connections. The connection varies per model. So visit Drobo.com to learn more about the Drobo B810i and to check out their complete line of products. Plus, when you use the code TWIT100, you'll save $100 off the purchase of a B810i or other selected Drobo models. That's Drobo.com and use the code TWIT100. We thank Drobo for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Brendan. Welcome to the show. Brendan?
Good morning.
Hi. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, yes, right. The guy that lives near me, but I'm not there. I'm actually in Pasadena, California, Captain Neal's house. So that's why it looks a little familiar. Right. Cool. And let's also bring on Nicole Ingard. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Hello.
And it's been so long since I've seen you. How did I bump into you recently?
So we were just at the Texas Linux Fest here in Austin, where I live, and you stopped by the Tic Tac booth, and you were looking so lost that I had to come out and see what it was you were looking for, and it just so happened you were looking for me.
Indeed, yeah. And so I'm safely out of that 100-degree temperature. Well, let's start with Brendan. Would you please give us the overview? What is Koha, and what problem is it solved?
Sure. So Koha is a ILS, like you were talking about earlier, and Douglas definitely said that it's an integrated library system. So originally it started in 1999 at the Horowhenua Library Trust in New Zealand. They had a system that had a Y2K bug. So they went out to tender to try to find and choose a new system. And there was a local development company that wanted to develop a system from the ground up for them. Both sides wanted to do it as an open source project. So originally it started in September of 99, and it went live on January 2nd of 2000. And that's basically the beginning of it. I got involved in 2007. I was working for a library system with having a lot of difficulty having access to my data. I wasn't able to get to it. And I stumbled across this project and fell in love with it.
Cool. So tell us more about what an ILS is. I mean, I'm guessing it's something used by libraries, more large libraries, maybe chains of libraries, to coordinate all the resources that are there and to tell you who's got what checked out and where things are loaned to.
Exactly. So on a very rudimentary level, you could think of it as an inventory system. It's most developers, when they start to get into it, they would think of it as, you know, it's just a glorified database. Except with librarians, there's some complex metadata formats that they use, and there's also a lot more of how libraries manage and try to create access points to the data. So what it is there's kind of two sides to it. There's a front-end side that users would use to search the collections and access data, both for physical collection management for the library and then also digital management of ebooks or audio files, etc. And then there's a back-end staff side, which the librarians use, and they use it to classify the data and to circulate it and be able to track it and get their materials back, and then also order it and do collection development.
Cool. Nicole, let's go to you for a bit. How did you get involved with the project?
I was working at a law library a long time ago, and I worked as a web developer there. And so my job was writing software for the librarians to use within the library. And when we had problems with the ILS we were using, they would come to me and ask me to try and fix the problems for them. And I always had to say no, because it was a proprietary system. And so I started to do some research, as a librarian does, and found Koha. And you read all about the history, started talking to the people in the community, and brought it into my library and said, hey, you know, take a look at this. We should probably use this instead. Then I can actually help you, you know, maintain it and fix it and make it what we need it to be. And the response was, no, we're comfortable where we are. And I basically said, well, I'm not. And so I started to look for ways that I could participate in the community until I got a paying gig working in the community.
Okay. Hey, I just realized I was probably pronouncing it Koho the entire time, for which I apologize. I don't know. Koho is a kind of fish. And I was thinking, okay, what is Koha? Is it an abbreviation?
No, it is not. So Koha is the Maori word for gift, but it's a special kind of gift, a gift that comes with expectations. And so with Koha, the expectation is that you will contribute back in some way. So you can take this gift from the Horowhenua Library Trust and you can use it in your library. And then they hope that you'll contribute back by either reporting issues, writing documentation, writing code, sharing with others, so on and so forth. And so in New Zealand, when you enter museums, instead of having a donation box at the door, they have a Koha box.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That is kind of amazing. And this is questions for either of you. So how deployed do you think Koha is? Is it like the number one open source ILS, or how would you characterize it?
It's the most downloaded ILS library software in the world. We don't have exact numbers, but I think it's somewhere over 15,000 installs around the world.
Wow, that's pretty extensive. Are they all talking to each other, or would that only be if there's a need for like a regional library sharing?
Some talk to each other. For example, in Turkey, the whole nation of Turkey is using Koha. I think it's like 1,200 so libraries. But then there's also individual installs in Nigeria, all over India, the U.S., all over the world. There's a lot of single installs, and then there's also group installs.
Is this something then that internationalization and localization would be pretty important to have in that?
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And so we actually have a website, translate.koha-community.org, where you can see the various different languages it's translated in. And then our quality assurance team is always looking at new features when they come in to make sure that they are going to, you know, handle special characters and be translatable as well.
What sense does this make sense to use for like my record collection at home? Is there a lot of setup and install that would be required, or is this something that's kind of a you can start simple and work your way up.
There is a live CD out there or live DVD now, so it's pretty easy for you to install off of that. If you want to be participating in the code as well, you're going to need, you know, Git installed and your usual setup, some sort of virtual machine. I've cataloged my collection in Koha, but I have been using Koha for 10 or more years now, so it wasn't hard for me.
Yeah, of course not. And like Brandon, you have a master's degree in library science. So this is probably something that's right up your alley.
It's definitely right up your alley. That's the metadata format that librarians use. It's called MARC, and it stands for like machine access readable something or description. And that's kind of very esoteric. So that part of cataloging or classifying your own collection, there's a little bit of a hurdle to get over that. Installing the software is quite easy, and we have Debian packages now, so that the install is accessible.
It probably doesn't take a gamer's machine either, right? It's probably just pretty straightforward.
Exactly.
Cool. I remember, actually, thinking back 10, 15 years ago, I remember the EyeSight camera on the Mac, when it was actually a separate little camera you plugged in on USB, I remember there was some program out there that I would hold up the UPC code of my DVDs and it categorized them and cataloged them for me. Is that part of the pathway to get data into this? Or can it be?
There are barcodes, and you're thinking of like a barcode scanner, so you can definitely use cameras from computers, and then librarians also have those barcode scanners that they use. Mainly, that is kind of more of like a keyboard input, so there's not too much programming on the iOS side to be able to handle that stuff.
Now, is this, you said that you talked a little about the front end stuff. Like, is this like when people are actually checking books out, they're entering data immediately into the ILS?
Yeah. So the front end is going to be the user side. Think of it as like the borrowers or the patrons, okay. And it's a like a search engine. So currently, we're Koha is using a search engine called Zebra, designed by Index Data. And there is development to be used in Elasticsearch now. And so basically it's the ability for you to be able to search and access material that you're looking for. And then there's both, I think the next big step for libraries or library systems and for Koha is to navigate away from this old metadata format to linked data and allowing other search engines from external sources to be able to harvest and be able to display some of this metadata that libraries all over the world have and are sitting on that they really need to get out there.
So I want to switch gears just a little bit, dig in just a little bit. We mentioned digital resource management earlier, which of course everybody knows about, the other digital resource management, the DRM on music and things. And that is a big, I guess, issue in libraries in general, having to do electronic subscriptions and things, so electronic checkouts. Is that the DRM that, you know, people hate, is that something, I mean, libraries have to do it. So, I mean, it would be a good thing if there were some of those things in there just to deal with the restrictions that publishers put on. So is that something that the Koha can deal with?
We're definitely on the same page with you that we're not so sure about a DRM. We're not crazy about it either. From a library standpoint and from Koha, you know, a DRM is kind of oxymoron, in my opinion, to have an open data. So Koha doesn't do much with the DRM management, if that makes sense. Right. Mainly what we do is we rely on the publishers or any third party supplier of digital resources that they manage it. And then what we do is we just write connectors into the publishers so that we could authenticate the borrowers.
Nice. So a question, I guess, more for Nicole on just because you mentioned the law library background. I was wondering if the whole trademark thing was something that, you know, if that was far enough back that you were involved, because I think that was longer than 10 years ago, but you said you had been using it for 10 years, and if maybe that's how you first got involved.
No, actually, the trademark thing still relatively recent in all of our memories, and it's not how I got involved at all. I was definitely part of that in, you know, all the different interviews and spreading information, and we even created a little bibliography that we were sharing publicly on Zotero with, you know, the issues back and forth. So. So, you know, I was definitely involved there, as was anybody active in the community pushing for Horafenua and the Koha community to get to retain that trademark.
Yeah, I may have gotten my dates mixed up, because there's like a huge history for anybody who wants to go and dig into the history. It's like everything that has ever happened in the project. It's really amazing. Like, I started to go through it all, and then I realized it was just too much. Do either of you work on this this history? Or?
We all do. So is basically, as we have something to add to the history, it's in Git, it's in the repository for Koha as well. So you know, we go in and we add, you know, new developers and things like that. And at one point, I remember I went back and I was looking for Kyle Hall, who's one of the developers at Bywater, who's been working on Koha longer than both of us, I believe, Brendan. I realized he got skipped in the history. And so I had to go all the way back and put Kyle in and then change, you know, the numbers for every other developer on that list. So, yes, we've all worked on it from time to time.
Right. Mainly all I've done with the history is just push the new history. I'm the release manager currently.
So another sort of changing gears question. We've talked a lot about libraries, and I think people have, you know, a conception of what a library is, certainly in the U.S. But I was wondering if you knew of any other sort of non-traditional libraries, sort of archives of various sorts that might be using the software that, you know, probably people that aren't interested in libraries, we probably unfortunately lost some of them. But maybe if they haven't gone yet, we can bring some of them back with this.
I'll let Nicole.
Yeah, we do have some special libraries with unique collections. One of the ones I got to visit that was really neat was the Goodspeed Opera House. Brendan, remind me what state I was in when I was visiting there.
Confused, apparently.
It was in Connecticut.
I'm sorry. Connecticut. Okay, thank you. We have a lot of libraries in New England, and so I sometimes forget all the places I visited. And so they were they wanted to catalog, you know, pieces of scores and, you know, tapes and notes from operas and things like that. And they didn't have any of this organized yet. And I honestly, I mean, I left that training saying to them, please call me up. And if you can ship me boxes of this stuff, I will catalog it for you. It was so exciting to like look through all this and really unique content. And then there are other, we have museum libraries that use our services as well. Yeah, there are definitely lots of different types of libraries using the software and unique ones.
Awesome.
We did work with American, I can never say it correctly, Newsmatics. Maybe Nicole can correct that for me. It's a stamp library. So they had collections of stamps, and they had their own classification system. That was pretty cool.
Nice. So you said you were the release manager, Brendan. How often, you know, what's that job like?
So we do major releases twice a year, in May and November. Being the release manager is – so with Koha, we use Bugzilla. and patches are submitted to Bugzilla, and then we have to have a sign-off done, and then there's a QA team, and once the QA team passes it, then the final review is done by the release manager, and then that is pushed to the master branch. And it's pretty active. Any month we have probably 60 to 70 unique developers that are submitting code. For the project history, it's a little bit over 300 of them have been submitted. And I'm per release, I think I've been pushing about 2,000 patches. And that's anywhere from a couple lines to a couple hundred lines of code.
How is this actually being managed in terms of what new features are going into the roadmap? Do you have some sort of foundation or executive committee or something that says this is where we're going, this is what we're still missing?
So there isn't exactly a executive committee. What we do is we have a conference once a year. It's a users conference, and we discuss a lot of these. We have a Hackfest where we talk about some plans for the future. We try to have a monthly meeting. Actually, there's two. There's a general IRC where it's sort of a majority vote on what sort of things the community is interested in and pushing forward with. And then we also have a developers meeting where we vote on things like coding guidelines or any kind of features. If anybody wants to submit a new plan forward or new features, they are asked to submit a RFC to the wiki, and any comments can happen there. And then we also ask that everyone creates a bug in Bugzilla first, and then any comments there and any alternative ideas or plans would go there.
And what sort of – we just had a question from the channel. Esol asks, did they mention the version control system? I don't think you have. Is it Git, I hope?
It's Git.
All right. Roger that. Except it wasn't Git 10 years ago probably.
It was Savannah or SourceForge. I forget.
That was probably the hosting service. It probably SVN.
SVN. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. I've been through all, and I mean all of the change control systems. It's been really crazy since they've been around so long. Oh, and I think it was right. Also Esol that even before the show saw your coding guidelines, and they talked about Perl. Is this thing in Perl?
It is.
Yay! Yay! Yes. But back when Perl ruled the world. Hooray, hooray. You know, it's funny because when I was reviewing the Evergreen stuff, they also said theirs was in Perl as well. Is it? Are all ILSs written in Perl?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess the open ones are.
Okay, yeah, right. You know, I'm always amazed. But of course, these are probably mostly legacy systems anyway. They're probably all created about the same time that we started all seeing the same need and had the open source technologies to be able to do that. And of course, Perl ruled the world back in the late 90s. So that sounds like the right time to have done all that. Plus, Perl provided all the neat web interfaces and CGI and all that wonderful stuff. Some of the stuff which I still deploy green today, you know, although I'm looking more at single page applications these days. So you described the size of the community. And actually, before I go on to that, I think Esol also asked, are you familiar with Evergreen? Can we compare this to the features Evergreen has?
We're very familiar with Evergreen. There's pros and cons to every system, and both are more collaborative. We both share the same SIP module. It's not for phones. It's something that libraries use that's used for authentication and also self-checkouts. Like if you go to a library, they have the self-checkout machines. Mm-hmm. The protocol for there, the same library is used in both systems for that. That's like a similar between the two. Mm-hmm. Evergreen and Koha are both open source projects of traditional ILSs, and it's not so the features are very similar. It's just that maybe the buttons would be in different spots, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Evergreen uses a client model. So there's a client that you have to download and install on your computer, and Koha is all web services based. And for features, they're both pretty similar in features. It's just kind of which flavor you like more, which look and feel you like a little bit more. Koha is much better on internationalization. So it's translated in like 85 different languages around the world. Evergreen doesn't have as broad of an approach. One thing, for example, that Koha does really well is, since it is such an international project, there are different rules and libraries around the world. So, for example, in the U.S., probably everyone's familiar with this, is if your book is overdue, usually you're charged fines for the number of days the book is overdue. Mm-hmm. Whereas in France, they have a different model, and their model is the number of days that your book is overdue, you are suspended from using the library for that number of days.
Hmm. It's a really interesting strategy. Yeah.
Love that. I wish that the U.S. would use that model instead of fines. I think fines kind of maybe limit some access to the library for some lower income people. But the advantage with Koha is that it's very forgiving, and it's very, very broad, at least in its programming, to be able to accept all these different policies from around the world.
And also, again, asking you as a library services, you know, obviously a library wants to be inclusive, but there are certain laws in certain countries about minors accessing certain types of materials. Does Koha deal with that at all?
Yes, you can establish rules based on like a patron category type.
Okay, cool. And again, I'm looking at, okay, if I were to look at the roadmap, where would I find the roadmap for Koha?
Nicole maybe has a better answer for that. I think it's on the wiki.
The answer is there actually isn't one, no official roadmap. It's mostly like I said, in the logs on the email list or, you know, following Bugzilla. It's different than a lot of other open source projects I've learned about in that way. It's very freeing. There is always, you know, when we're talking about things like Brendan mentioned that we're going to be using Elastic now as a search engine, that had a roadmap. You know, we had plans for that kind of large addition to the software. But there is no, you know, next year we're going to add in the ability to, you know, I can't even come up with anything. But yeah, there's no list of features that are coming at certain times other than Bugzilla is what I always refer to.
Okay.
So we've talked a lot about the checkout process because that's obviously an important aspect of libraries. But libraries these days do a lot more like computer access, children's programs, teen programs, things like that. Is there anything built into the ILS to support those functions of the library?
Not yet. That's a big one that a lot of people do ask for, you know, the ability to manage their programs in there. We were talking with the library about how we could integrate their calendar into the search results, and the dev team at Bywater seemed pretty excited about that. So we're sort of talking about that with one of our library partners. We also know of, you know, many room booking open source applications out there. So we're looking at a few of those to see if we can integrate those into Koha or come up with a connector of some sort there so that people can do that. Because we do have in Omaha, there is DoSpace, which is a non-traditional library where they have only computers, 3D printers, a lot of interactive devices. And so booking rooms and booking hardware is a big thing for them. And so we've been talking to them about ways we can integrate that into Koha for them.
Yeah, and we've mentioned a lot on here about other open source programs. You just mentioned potentially, you know, using booking, either building it in or, you know, somehow putting them together. I was just wondering, you know, it seems to me, but it may not seem to a lot of people, that open source and libraries sort of go hand in hand. You know, like the free access part of the library was always very important to me. So I guess if both of you could just speak a little bit about that, just because I think it may be something that we're making some assumptions about, but we should probably verbalize.
You know, I wrote practical open source software for libraries many years ago now. I think we're at 6 years. That was like the key throughout the entire book. And it's also the key through all of my presentations. It makes perfect sense for libraries to use and participate in open source software because of all the reasons you just listed. However, what we're seeing is a bit of a slow uptake. At the American Library Association conference last month, there was a lot of talk about open, and that was new. In general, to hear so much talk about open, because we have lived in such, when it comes to software, such a proprietary world for so long. And so there's a lot of barriers that we're trying to break down and a lot of misconceptions and FUD that we're fighting through to show folks that open source for, you know, all their software makes sense. And there are some libraries that get it. There's some really awesome libraries out there using, you know, lots and lots of open source. And then there are others that, you know, just too scared of the change to make that leap. But I think after years of education on my part and other open source, evangelists out there, we're finally getting to the point where I think libraries are starting to catch on.
That's interesting. And maybe it's just because, you know, I was in academia, so like, academia and sort of open access sort of go together. Because I'm just surprised that you have to fight the fight, but I'm glad you're out there fighting the good fight. And Brendan, I guess I sort of interrupted before you got a chance to answer.
No. Excellent point and excellent question, by the way. So for me, I think of Carnegie and creating free libraries, and libraries should be free, that it just goes hand in hand that your software should be free too. And just the whole idea, exactly what you said, for academia, you are sitting on so much knowledge, and it should be free. And then for you to be able to access that data and have complete control over that and choice about what you want to share freely, it just goes hand in hand with what librarians do. And then to just bring it one step further, the reason I think Koha does so well is because it's designed by librarians. The choices of what goes into it is it's all library user, library, librarian driven.
Well, saying that, is there some way that I, who's only been into a library as recently as 15, 20 years ago, would I still be able to help with the project? What kinds of people are you looking for to move things forward?
Any and all people. So there's lots of things that you can do. Now, it's we're getting into interesting stuff because the whole digital model of people getting into ebooks or e-audio or anything like that now. And I think that any pressure that's brought to a library to be able to access those that are free. And also Nicole talked a little bit about the makerspace. I think that part of going into a makerspace, you could look at it, you could also provide digital publishing. And I think that anyone that wanted to do publishing, they should go to their library and encourage the library to offer some kind of platform for people to be able to submit that, be able to have a place to publish, and connecting that free data into a free system. It matches for what a librarian should be doing.
Awesome. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'd add that, you know, other ways that folks can contribute is, one of the things we hear about from all open source communities, we'd love some, you know, more people who know design aspects participating. We have Owen Leonard, who is awesome, and he is our you know, GUI guru. But you know, we would, you know, more people that can help him in that area. And then documentation, I am the sole documentation manager at this moment. So anybody who like pops into the software and you know, uses a piece of it and thinks, hey, this documentation could be improved, it'd be great to start seeing more patches coming in from that way. So there's lots of ways that people who are not actually in the library or working in the library can participate and improve the product.
And just as an aside, I'm told by the powers that be here that there was a segment on Makerspace on Screensavers, a fellow Twitch show, on the last Saturday, and apparently they made the point that they are the modern public library. So definitely that's a great idea, and it sounds like it's being propagated quite a bit. Before we get too far along in the show, because we are starting to run out of time, what's the licensing for this? Is this like MIT or GPL2 or something?
It's a GPL3, I think, or GPL2 plus. I can get that for you. One sec.
That's fine. It's something GPL is. And do you need to sign a contributor agreement when you contribute, or do you still retain your own copyright?
There's no agreement.
So it doesn't mean there's any way that you could globally change the license to something even smarter or something. So if there's no assignment, then that's definitely locks everything in. I know that when I contributed to GNU Emacs, I had to do a copyright assignment. So a little bit of my code and every copy of Emacs that goes out the door. It's pretty cool. And how is this? This is a lot of labor, tons and tons of labor. Is this all just a labor of love for everyone, or is there some funding model for this?
So currently how it works is it's all volunteer. Now there are companies that provide support services on this. There's I believe maybe around 17 or 20 or something like that around the world who are using a support and hosting an installation and like development contract model. Now they are all submitting code that customers are asking them to write or librarians are asking them to write. They submit that. But mainly there are positions within the community. There's some QA people that are part of a QA committee. There's the release manager. There's the documentation manager. Now I'd say for Nicole, we work together at Bywater Solutions, and part of her job is to do the documentation, but she also spends a lot of her own time, volunteer time on that. I'm the release manager. I do a little bit of that during work, but I also do a lot of it after hours. So volunteer time. The QA manager does it all after her work. I'd say that a majority of all of the work that's done per release is done by volunteers. Now we just started a funding committee, and there's kind of two sides to it. There's a committee that is challenged with raising money for the project, and then there's also the committee that decides on how to spend the money that we've made. So currently we have not had a lot of fundraising. There's only been that company model where a company has somebody that they pay to work for them and they contribute to the community. I think that the goal of this funding committee is as we raise money, then we should that funding committee should start paying people to do these roles in the community full time. So we should have a funded release manager. We should have a funded QA person, a funded documentation manager, et cetera. And then also, do some of the developments that pay people to do developments that sometimes are hard to get libraries to fund. For example, a lot of the public libraries that we work with, we support over 1,000 libraries in the US. And they usually, for their funding organization, like a town council or something like that, they usually have to have something that they come back and show to the council as a new feature added. And there are some plumbing needs that need to happen, you know, update of code, changing of some variables, you know, adding fast CGI, et cetera, et cetera. And those are harder to get funded from a library standpoint. And I think that the International Fund should definitely be funding that kind of development.
How easy is this to use for someone who's maybe has their master's in library and then hasn't worked with an ILS before? Or is that even possible?
So
we actually started Brendan.
Go ahead, Nicole.
We started a program at Bywater actually called Koha Classmates, class with a K, where we're actually offering free installs of Koha to library school classrooms so that library and information science professors can teach on Koha so that when these students go into the libraries, they are familiar with it and what an ILS looks like and how to use it. So we have about 20 library schools using it so far. So that's a start. But most of our education in our library degree does not include using the actual software. And so as long as you have a basic understanding of how web interfaces work, it's pretty easy to pick up, as long as you also know the jargon, which you should from library school. I sat down to teach myself Koha from scratch, and now I write the manual. So it is doable, but we are trying to fix that barrier to entry by showing Koha in the classroom now.
Okay. Hey, we're almost out of time, as I said again, and I do want to make sure that we've covered everything that you considered essential. Is there anything we didn't ask that you want to make sure our audience is aware of? Both of you.
The one thing that I would want to add is that it's a great community. This open source project is, I've developed some of what I would consider my closest friends through this, and that the community is the power behind the software. That's the people. And that if anyone wants to join in the IRC meetings to see how we're doing, there's some fabulous open source minds that are involved with this project. And I would just love to see more people talk about it and really celebrate some of these unsung heroes that are in our community.
Anything for you, Nicole?
I second that. Yeah, I second that. This community is amazing. I always feel sad when I go to talks at open source conferences with people complaining about, troubles within their community, because we really haven't had that amongst the members of our community. So if you're looking for a very welcoming and friendly community, come on and join us.
Cool. That's great follow-ups there. I do have two questions I must ask both of you because it's a required. I think I already know the answer to one of them, though. We'll start with you, Brendan. What's your favorite scripting language?
Perl.
Yay! Finally. I knew that was going to be the right answer. And what's your favorite text editor?
Vim.
Okay. One out of two isn't bad. Same two questions, Nicole.
I'm going to say PHP and Vim.
Okay. I that makes sense, I guess. But it's really nice, again, like I said, to hear that a big project uses Perl. We're out of time, so I just want to say thank you to both of you, Brendan Gallagher-Hengard. And Nicole, actually, I think I'm going to be seeing you on a future show. We'll discuss that offline, okay?
Great. Sounds awesome.
All right. That was Brendan Gallagher and Nicole Engard talking about Koha, not Koho. What do you think Douglas?
Really interesting project. I mean, the whole thing with open source communities doing different projects, but keeping things separate, like with the Evergreen, it's always interesting. There's always that debate about whether or not that places should combine forces and have an even better product. But it really seems like in this case, people are really downloading and using the project, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of need for, it can always be better, but they seem to be doing quite well.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful to realize that you don't need a bunch of closed source to do this kind of fairly intense, management of resources and cataloging and searching and everything else like that. I'm glad they're using Elastic now to be able to do probably even better searches.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't ask what database backend they're using, though, but that's okay. They're gone. Okay, so let's look at what's coming up. We've got Karina next week, which is an easy-to-use, instant-on, native container environment from Rackspace. And we have someone from Capital One talking about their foray into the open-source world. So they're actually releasing already an application called Hygieia, which is a monitoring dashboard. And that's something almost every big data center needs, you know, those big war room screens. So that'll be cool. But they apparently are going to have like another half dozen that are sort of in the works of being released. And this is stuff that Capital One has been using there. We have the Cluster HQ projects. Those are things like Flocker, Devol, Elliot, Machinist, and PowerStrip, of which I know nothing about any of those. Some of you may recognize some of those names, though, but we'll have some people on who can help me get information about all that. There's also a Linux Presentation Day. That's apparently a European event that on the same day in all sorts of countries all over the European Union and also England, since they're now working their way out. So I'm hoping to get a very special co-host back for that. We're working on it, and he's almost given his approval. Then LucidWorks had to cancel and reschedule, but they're still in the schedule again. That's all about searching your data, finding your data in appropriate places. We've scheduled Nobody News since last week's show, but I tell you, we've got a whole bunch of people in the queue. Most of the ones I got at Red Hat Summit. I was there for a couple of days in San Francisco. The weather was pleasant, unlike other cities that I've been recently. From that, we're going to get back Ansible. We had them on many, many years ago, but they've really changed a lot of stuff in it. Overt, same thing. Again, many years ago, we had them on. Manage IQ, don't quite remember what that was. We're going to bring back my very first guest that I ever lined up for Floss Weekly, and that's Josh Berkus, who talked to us about Postgres. Well, he's now working at Red Hat on their Atomic project. So we'll get him on to talk about what that's all about. OpenShift Origin and Gluster. So if you recognize some of those names, that's great. We'll be having them on the show very soon, as soon as I have open slots again. We are starting to open up Q4 because Q3 is almost full. We do a live stream when we tape this show. It's at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. Is it live at twit.tv? Thanks to Esol and Jay Bennett for their and others, probably. I'm probably leaving somebody out for their questions today. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and on at Floss Weekly on Twitter. Twitter one is just actually a mirror of the one on Google Plus. You can follow me as Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and as Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. Rare occasional original content on Twitter. Mostly it's Google Plus. I was at Red Hat's bunch of names. I was at Texas Linux Fest where I actually met Nicole, one of our guests. That was really great. I will not be Slay. I think it's already passed, but I'm definitely was a little afraid of the Zika virus. I'm not going down there. I will be in Hotlanta on Labor Day weekend for DragonCon on the EFF track, about 5 panels, and I'm still waiting to hear back if I'm getting on any of the podcasting panels. So that is everything I have to plug. Douglas, do you have anything you want to plug?
Well, I'm going to be at Mini Demo 23 on Thursday, so that's Mini for Minneapolis, and it's basically... they do demos, that's in the name, but it's sort of the long-term standing of their bar camp thing here. And so I'm new to the city, so I will be going there and trying to meet as many people as I possibly can.
Awesome. Well, you did a great job as your first day on the show. In fact, I like that one of the guests gave you an excellent question. So that's the badge of honor, and I guess that means you pass all the tests. So you'll be back sometime soon. We'll talk offline about when you schedule you, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, and thank you for co-hosting today's show, and thank you all in the audience for watching or listening as appropriate, because we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.